Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, it's obvious. I'm John Verhoeven, and I was a cop back in the 80s in Sydney.
And I'm Paul Verhoeven, John's son. I'm an author, and I wrote two books about Dad's time as a cop.
The first five seasons of Loose Unit spanned my time in general duties, forensics, my time as a firefighter, and even my stint running a funeral home.
This season, we're visiting the locations of Australia's most notorious, baffling, horrific crimes, and looking at what happened there.
From Snowtown to the family. From the Morehouse murders to haunted highways. This season of Loose Units is your go-to guide to the worst crimes in Australian true crime history.
Welcome to Loose Units, The Shadow Files. Hello and welcome to Loose Units, The Shadow Files. Every week, Dad and I talk about all kinds of true crime-related stuff. Usually it's Australian-based or, you know, New Zealand, as was the case a couple of weeks ago. But occasionally, we stray overseas. And for me, that's where things get a little interesting because, listeners, I don't know about you, but I avoided true crime and crime in general for many, many years. And I guess that's kind of understandable, Dad, given that the stories that you were telling when we were growing up were so harrowing. I think I wanted to just look in the other direction. But now, true crime and crime in general, they're kind of our jobs. I mean, they're kind of our careers. And we watch a lot of TV shows about crime. We read books. We immerse ourselves in this world. But sometimes there are gaps in my knowledge, right? There are key figures in the world of true crime that I just didn't know about. Now, today we're beginning a multi-episode look at someone called the BTK Killer. I didn't know who this was, so I have to ask, Dad, why did you want to talk about this killer right now? What triggered this series of events?
Great question. Christine and I weirdly seem to spend most of our time, you and the listeners may be aware. Yeah. I know you are, Paul, but I'm not sure whether the listeners are aware, but I disconnected our free-to-air TV channel, cable. I just yanked it out of the wall. It was a minor epiphany where I discovered that one could actually disengage from sort of mainstream commercial television. But what we do find ourselves doing at nighttime, and this is a bit of a hand-on-heart admission, is that Christine and I are not obsessed, but we spend a lot of our time watching true crime and also movies about bad shit.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think two people who worked in the emergency services would feel the need to kind of go, not feel the need, but be compelled to intake narratives about these atrocities?
Well, it's such a great question. And we, you know, we have a number of sort of subscriber-based channels, and one of them is Netflix.
Yeah.
And we have watched one series three times. So, Paul, the show is called Mindhunter.
Ah, yes.
And it has a great cast. It's a fairly small cast, but they delve into the... It's, as I said, it's the genesis of the Behavioral Research Unit. And when it first started in the FBI in the 60s, It was poo-pooed and disregarded by a lot of the contemporaries of the time within the Bureau. And it took a couple of sort of, I guess, people within the Bureau that had great foresight, a little bit like science fiction writers. They have a sense of things to come, things to pass. And they created this unit, and it was a very, very small unit, consisted of two people in the very beginning. And what they did is they went out and interviewed some of the most extraordinary Well, we call them today serial killers. That term serial killer was formulated, was created during that period, and it became synonymous with the type of killer. And they delve into Charles Manson, all the most notorious serial killers. But at the beginning of every single episode, there is a sort of a like a micro scene before each episode starts.
Yeah.
And it's simply a man in his, well, he's got receding, well, he's bald in the middle with patches either side. He's got glasses. He's got a goatee.
Distinct look, yeah.
Yeah. And he is sitting in a white van, for example, which is sort of a telecommunications van, in Wichita, which is in Kansas. And every single episode, you get about a minute, minute and a half. And I get the sense that this was going to be the genesis for a third season, where they were going to ultimately bring all sort of the small scenes, piece them together, and then create this terrible story about a person. And I never really knew whether this was a fictitious character. But then, of course, I did some research, and I came up with the BTK killer.
Wait, so the person sort of not stalking these characters in Mindhunter were... That was a real person. That was BTK.
Paul, in the last... Without giving... Because we're not really giving anything away about the actual series.
Okay.
But I will say this, that we have talked about autoeroticism over the years.
Yeah.
And in the final sort of teaser that never came to fruition, because the season, the whole series was canned, much to universal sadness.
Everyone's pissed about that, by the way. Everyone wanted this show to happen.
That's right. But the last scene is so disturbing. Christine and I looked at each other and thought, wow, this is really creepy. And it's a scene involving this person, and his wife comes home, and the bathroom door is vibrating with intensity. That's all I'm going to tell you. Go and watch it. But then, of course, I wanted to know more
about this BTK killer who was cameoing in the show, effectively.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And then if I was a serving police officer back in the day, or if I was a police officer now and this particular case came to light, I have a terrible feeling, listeners, that I would become so obsessed with it that I would want to spend the rest of my life pursuing this person.
Right.
It is, without a doubt, the most fascinating and, for me, disturbing case that we've ever done in all the years of our podcasting. This is the one, for so many reasons. It's not the numbers, but it's a big number.
Yeah.
But the more you delve into this particular person and his openness and frankness in court, he is a true psychopath.
Yeah. We've been referring to him as the BTK killer, but his actual name is Dennis Lynn Rader. And he was born in 9th of March 1945, so I think he's in his 70s at the moment.
He's getting very close to 80 now. Yeah.
Okay.
And things in the very early years, you know, appeared to be fairly normal, but he was described by his peers as someone that didn't stand out. He sort of blended into the crowd, but he, like many people that end up doing terrible things, there was a sort of a predisposition or a tendency to be cruel to animals.
Do you think I know that siblings are an interesting kind of psychological topic, depending on... Yeah, there's lots of arguments that if you're the middle child, you have sort of complexes, eldest, youngest, whatever, but he's the eldest of four. And he was born in Pittsburgh in Kansas, but the majority... Because he ended up in Wichita. And
correct.
the majority of these crimes happened in and around Wichita. But, you know, he graduated from Wichita Heights High School. He was a member of the Zion Lutheran Church. He was a churchgoer. That's going to become important later on. I mean, this seems like a pretty kind of normal, scare quotes, all-American sort of upbringing, right?
I agree. And he ultimately got married.
Yeah.
And he had two, he and his wife had two children.
Right.
And he, as you say, was a member of the local church. When his son became old enough, he became a scout leader.
Yeah.
Or cub leader. Which is very important to remember.
Actually, Dad, let me stop you right there. Have you heard of the McDonald Triad?
No.
Okay. So in 1963, a psychiatrist called J.M. McDonald published a study which was extremely controversial. And even McDonald himself admitted that it was this wasn't, you know, meant to be used in this way. But law enforcement and the legal profession ran with it. And the argument, the idea that he raised in this study, which was carried through to its extreme conclusion, was that there are three signs that would indicate whether someone will grow up to be a serial killer or a violent criminal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, if you possess two out of three of these qualities as a kid, you're meant to be in some sort of red zone for, you know, you could end up being a serial killer. So the McDonald Triad, as it's called, the three signs that are meant to be indicators, early indicators, one is being cruel or abusive to animals, especially pets. Number two is setting fire to objects or otherwise committing minor acts of arson. And number three is regularly wetting the bed. Now, listeners, I wet the bed a fair bit as a kid, and I set fire to a few things.
I think that those three things, I think maybe the first one.
Yeah, but they've been, I mean, it's been discounted.
It's absolute. That's, to me, that's just absolute codswallop.
Yeah, it's BS, but I mean, one of the things that even Rader himself admitted is that he, because he confessed this later on, many, many people reported, as you mentioned a couple of minutes back, that he hurt animals. He tortured animals when he was a kid. Yeah. He had a major sexual fetish for ladies' underwear, which was, again, that's going to come up later on. Now, I'm not saying the McDonald Triad bears any credence, but as somebody who's been dealing with crime for a long time, I think you can agree that people who hurt animals as kids, I think that is actually still one of the big red flags. Put the triad aside. The fact that he tortured animals when he was a kid is a massive warning sign to me. Which
I agree. But then when he joined the Air Force, he was stationed in Okinawa.
Right, okay.
For a couple of years, four years.
Yeah, other places too. He was in Greece for a
while. Korea, yeah, Turkey.
Yeah, okay.
Now, in those years that he was in the military, posted overseas, he started having numerous sexual encounters with prostitutes. Now, that is not uncommon, particularly when during, if you're in the services and you're overseas, you know, and you're a young person, male or female.
He was there between ages of like 21 to 25. That's correct. You know, that's prime young man.
But there's the red flag for me.
Yeah.
Is that whilst he was doing that, and that to a point is relatively, should we say, I'm just trying to pick the right word without pissing people off. I can't think of the word, but let's just say that is not so out of the ordinary. Yeah. However, it's then that he decides to stalk prostitutes. And what he's doing, he's testing a theory that he's got, that he can stalk people without them knowing they're being stalked. And he's practicing. Now, we don't know why. He may not even know why.
Mm-hmm.
He's just gaining thrills, but then, and this comes out in court later on.
Yeah.
He also says one of the things he really prided himself on was the ability to break into military libraries after hours and steal books and not get caught. Now, that's interesting on a couple of levels.
Why?
He's testing his ability to break into places. particularly a military establishment, where the adrenaline would be coursing through every vein in his body, giving him heightened sexual tension. He's stealing books, which is interesting in that he actually is fairly learned, which is, again, a point to remember, because as we delve more into this particular horrendous case, what he does is he ultimately sends letters and notes to various agencies, but he does what a couple of very famous mass murderers did, and he dumbs himself down. He uses incorrect grammar. But as it's pointed out, he was a literate person. He did go to university. He did gain ultimately a degree in electrical engineering. And when he tried to feign this sort of low intelligence with his letters, as experts pointed out, some of the key words within the construct of his letters, which were complex words, were spelt correctly. So he fucked up. So this whole thing about adrenaline, maybe he didn't know the ultimate course. I'm sure there are lots of people in the world that, as life goes on, they have a certain trajectory. Then something happens, either good or bad, and sort of, you know, we all make choices, crossroads.
Okay, so Daddy comes back. I think he gets a bunch of just regular jobs. He worked at a supermarket for a while.
Yep.
His mum was a bookkeeper at an IGA, a supermarket in Park City, I think, and he worked there. And then he went to... Okay, so you mentioned he's smart, right? You mentioned he's educated. And I think at this point it's worth mentioning he went to community college and he got an associate's degree in electronics. And then he went to university and he got a degree which I find absolutely baffling. So he graduated in 1979 with a bachelor's degree in administration of justice. That seems a touch ironic. And then, but by this point, he'd already been married to a woman called Paula Deitz. He married her in 1971 and they had two children, correct? A son and a daughter. Okay.
But he also... it was gleaned later on that he also wanted to become a police officer. And interestingly, the sorts of jobs... He gets a job with... you recall I mentioned that he was traveling around Wichita in a white van and he'd be outside people's houses.
So was this he was working for the cult... Was that... Okay, so he had a bunch of jobs, Dad. The first job chronologically, before we get to the van, from 72 to 73... He was working for a camping gear company called the Coleman Company. Now, that's really important because they say that serial killers will pick victims from places they see. So a couple of episodes back, a couple of weeks, months back, we talked about a killer who was opportunistic in that they were trying to figure out, you know, he was in and around the places that the victims were. So they weren't just random crimes. They were people that he saw on the way to and from places. So Rader was working for this Coleman company, the camping gear company. That's going to become important. You were mentioning, I believe, the job involving the van. Now, was that the services?
Yeah, he was actually offering advice and installing, get ready for this, burglar alarms. So he'd go in and he'd be, generally, it's a daytime job and without being sort of very stereotypical, the facts are that most houses in middle America, middle Australia, the husbands generally were at work. This is back in the day where it was, things were just... I guess economically, in terms of being able to afford a, you know, a mortgage, it could be done on one wage. I mean, that's laughable today. It's impossible. Both, you know, if you want to sort of get anywhere, it's just tough being on one wage.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So a lot of women were at home. Because women are at home, you know, during the day,
yeah.
It's very prudent when someone comes to talk about alarms. You're going to talk about all those sorts of things that could possibly happen whilst your partner, for example, is at work.
And he's going to ask. He's going to say, you're married, of course. He's going to, you know,
oh.
In order to provide the service, he goes, so what kind of a schedule do you keep? And he's literally getting to recon. This is the stuff of horror films,
yes.
Dad. Yep. But I will say this much. I was curious as to how much damage somebody could do in a position like this. You know, what kind of a window, time-wise, he could spend scoping out these houses. Just for a bit of context, he was employed by this company from 1974 through to 1988. That's
a long time.
That's a long time. That is 8, 9, 10...
14 years.
14 years. Okay. And he was fired in July 1988. But that's a long time working in this job where he is walking around people's houses, looking at their alarm systems, finding out points of entry and exit. And he was a manager at one point there, I believe. He was an installation manager. So he kind of... Oh, this is really upsetting. Okay.
I know. But I think it's time to talk about the first venture.
Yeah. And before we get to the things he did, there's a couple more work-related things here, which I think pertain to the bad stuff we're about to talk about. So he did some federal census taking. In, I think, 89, just before the 1990 census. And as we know, census takers also have a fairly unique trusted position where they can just walk up and say hello, ask how many people are living in the house. You know, they can ask for personal details. So that's a little intense. Then in 1991, so he's fired from this security job in 88. And then in 91, he is hired to deal with animal control, zoning, things like that. Now, he had a bit of a reputation in this job for being pretty intense. And one person complained that he, and I quote, euthanized her dog for no reason.
That's right. Yeah.
So again, that does tie into the animal cruelty. And he was fired from this job on March the 2nd, 2005, because he didn't report to work or call in. That's going to be important later on. He was also involved in the, as mentioned, he was a tad churchy. He was part of the Lutheran Church.
The Scout Movement.
Yep, he was on all kinds of like councils. There is a trope and a cliche that someone is a pillar of the community. I don't think he was that. I am just saying that he was involved in sort of various positions of semi-authority, right?
Yes.
And a lot of the positions he was in would give him access to people. I think now is the time for us to, now that we've sort of taken a zoomed out look into who he was growing up, some of his odd tendencies and some of the warning signs, and also a extensive timeline of his career, which gave him access to people and places which a normal person wouldn't have had. Let's snap back to January 15th, my birthday, unfortunately, 1974.
Okay, so one of the things about Dennis,
yes,
is he's smart. He doesn't stand out in a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
He has access. He's in a small town where you... The small town thing I find also problematic in terms of close proximity to victims. You wonder how you can sort of stalk and sit off houses and just get a sense of your future potential victims.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's working for and against you, because wouldn't you stand out?
You mean, wouldn't they go, this guy was just here?
Yeah. I mean, and they never... Look, anyway, I guess we need to sort of get... sort of start... I will give this particular man... I'm not going to use the word credit.
That's but cool. I am... Yeah, Raider, I think is a
good... Raider, I'm going to just say this from the outset.
Yeah.
He was non-discriminate. He was not your classic. Even though his MO is unique to him.
Yeah.
Like a calling card.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the first case, he, as we're going to hear... He goes in and, you know, look, let's just set the scene, Paul. It's in the morning.
Yep.
It's a weekday.
Yep.
And he breaks into this house, and before he breaks into the house, he gathers together what he described in court as his hit kit.
Okay.
It's a kit. Gun, knife. Very importantly, Venetian blind cord cut into lengths.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic bags.
Yep.
What else did he have? It was basically everything he needed to commit the crime. But just before he goes into the house, he cuts the telephone line. He does that, obviously, because... he goes in and to commit a terrible crime, and he doesn't want anyone being able to call, 911. Inside this particular house,
mm-hmm.
he was expecting, because of his stalking...
He was expecting the Mrs. Otero and the kids, right?
Correct.
The two, well, there were multiple kids. He was expecting the two younger children because he'd figured out that they would be there during the day. He came in... I'm going to read here from the court transcript. The judge says, all right, how did you get into the house? So Raider says, I came through the back door, cut the phone lines, waited at the back door, had reservations about even going or just walking away, but pretty soon the door opened and I was in. And the judge says, all right, so the door opened. Was it opened for you? This is difficult. Raider says, I think one of the kids, I think Junior, the younger Joseph opened the door. He probably let the dog out. The dog was in the house at that time. The judge says, all right, when you went into the house, what happened? He says, well, I confronted the family. I pulled a pistol. And at this point, he says, I confronted Mr. Otero. So he wasn't expecting the husband, was he?
No. And Mr. Otero had been in the military.
Right.
At the same time as Mr. Raider.
Mm-hmm.
But... Mr. Otero and his wife were both martial arts experts. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Mm.
Do you know which martial
art?
Judo, okay.
But they're all of a sudden... Firstly, Raider is confronted by the husband that he wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of the kids have gone to school.
Yeah.
He's got this... We can talk about his MO because he's going to use this MO every single time.
Mm-hmm.
And he simply says that he's basically a fugitive. He's a wanted man. He's got the gun. He needs some food. He needs to get some sustenance. He needs the keys to their car.
Yeah.
And he is on the run from the police. So it's one of those situations. So he creates, if you're the victims in your own home and someone breaks in and says all this to you, the last thing you're thinking of is that it's going to end badly. What you're going to think is that if we go along with this person and give them everything they want...
And logically speaking, we'll get out of this alive.
We're going to get out.
Now, something interesting he says here after he mentions the husband, he says, I confronted Mr. Otero and asked him to that I was there, that basically I was wanted. I wanted to get the car. I was hungry, food. I was wanted. I'm confused here. He's rambling a bit. But the hungry and the car, it seems like he's heading in and asking for... Look, I don't think he was entirely clear with them as to what he was after, but it does sound like he made it sound like he was robbing them. But it says here, I asked him to lie down in the living room. At that time, I realized it wouldn't be a really good idea. So I finally, the dog was a real problem. So I asked Mr. Otero to get the dog out. So he had one of the kids put it up. And then I took them back into the bedroom. So this is four family members at this point. And like you said, these family members have probably been told that he wants, you know, money, food, car, whatever. But they clearly don't know what's going to happen to them. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have been so compliant, like you said.
Mm. Mm. So he He strangles the husband and...
Plastic bag, right?
With plastic bags.
Yeah.
You know, suffocates him.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the wife, he does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's
a terrible quote here, which I've seen in multiple sources. He says, "I'd never strangled anyone before, so I didn't really know how much pressure you had to put on a person or how long it would take."
Mm.
So this is his first time doing this. I mean, as we've mentioned, he hurt animals, but he's never killed people before. And he's doing it all sort of in this odd group setting in the bedroom of the Otero house.
Yeah. Okay. And then once he's killed the mother and father,
mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, you'd think, I mean, I, as a rational person, which is mad to say, would then think, okay, I'm out of here. But no, he then murders the young boy. And then he takes the daughter, who is 11, her name's Josephine.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it says here that when he goes back after having sort of messed around because he wasn't sure who was dead and what, he was putting cloths over their heads. Because he was basically doing trial and error. It says here, "Then when I went back, Josephine had woken up. I took her to the basement and eventually hung her." So this is probably the most contentious part of this first series of murders, right? So he strangles her, she wakes back up, and then what does he do to her?
He removes her panties,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't sexually assault her. What he does in front of her hanging is that he then releases his sexual tension, and they find his sperm on her panties. Because what happens, Paul, is that the other brothers and sisters were coming home from school, and the children go into the house. They go into their mother and father's room, and they see both of them dead. And Paul, this is rather terrible what I'm about to say. When the children were interviewed, the first thing they thought was that the parents were just acting. They thought this whole thing was just a they just couldn't believe it.
And it was the 15-year-old came in and found them first. I mean, he was gone at this point.
He'd gone, yeah.
He wasn't just gone. He'd actually stolen some things. So he's sort of in a daze. These are his first murders.
Yeah.
He's had some sort of horrifying sexual release. There's four dead people, this family.
Mm.
He steals the father's watch. He takes Mr. Otero's watch, and then he steals a radio. But when asked in the court, he says he doesn't know why he did it. He gets the keys to the car, right? Although he says later on he thinks he may have already taken the keys by this point, but everything's a bit of a daze. He does a sort of odd preliminary clean of the house using something he refers to as the right-hand rule, where you go from room to room and pick everything up. And then he heads out through the front door, goes over to their car, drives over to somewhere called Dylan's, which I assume is a store, dumps the car there, and then walks from there back to his car. And then the children come and find the family, right?
Yeah. And then the police come in and...
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine that scene. I mean, particularly when you're dealing with young children, but to go downstairs and find the daughter hanging is just, you know...
So that's the... Yeah, so Dylan's is a store on the corner of Central and Oliver. And this is 1974, January 15th.
Yeah. And I think, Paul, that's the beginning of this terrible story.
I will say this much. The next crime takes place that year.
Mm.
Typically speaking, with serial killers, it feels to me like the crimes kind of ratchet up. Like they escalate slowly. Is that correct?
Yeah. Look, as we're going to find out lots and lots of disturbing things. We're going to find out that there was a period of time in between each crime, and we can understand for those that are going to say, well, hang on, why is there this time between? But it's to do with what he takes from the scene and how he uses these things to basically, without going into too much detail at this stage, he uses these items that he steals from the victims to trigger a sexual response that then gives him a release that enables him to basically get by, I suppose, live his so-called normal life until...
Gives him a fix, yeah.
Yeah, he's getting a fix, and we will talk about how he does that.
Yeah, this is such a disturbing case. The next crime happens April the 4th, 1974, and we will be dealing with that next episode. Well, the next episode of The Shadow Files, because as usual, later this week, we're going to be back with an episode of Loose Ends. There is so much to talk about, including updates on the deeply tragic Samantha Murphy disappearance. We'll be dealing with that. We'll be talking about a whole bunch of stuff, actually. So thank you so much for listening to this deeply disturbing episode of Loose Units, The Shadow Files. We know these episodes can be pretty intense. We know they can be pretty triggering, but this is going to be a multi-episode look at the BTK killer, Dennis L. Rader. This is harrowing stuff. It took place back in the 70s, but as you will find out over the coming weeks of our look at Rader, this case has stretched far closer to the present day than I ever thought possible. Make sure you head across to our Facebook page and check in, become a member, leave a... And, oh, and also, by the way, folks, if you're enjoying this show, if you've been listening, if you're a loyal listener to Loose Units, a lot of alliteration there, one thing we really, really appreciate is heading across to the Apple podcast page or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and leave a rating and a review. It is such a quick, easy thing to do. You just go to the page, hit five stars. Let's be honest, five stars is the nice thing to do. So yeah, give us a rating and a review, even just a few words. Love it. Thanks for the show. You know, do recommend. It takes a couple of seconds and it has such a lasting impact. This show has been going for, I mean, over 5 years, hundreds and hundreds. And this season alone has had hundreds of episodes. And Dad and I have got a massive next season planned. We've got a whole bunch of ideas. We've got live shows planned. So if you want to support us, head across to the Facebook page, leave us a rating and a review, and forgive all the housekeeping. But another thing you can do to support Loose Units is head across to Booktopia, Amazon, wherever, and grab a copy or copies of Electric Blue and Loose Units. That's a really helpful thing to do, because there is a third book planned that I'd like to get out. And also, keep your ears peeled for live shows, because I know we talk about this a lot, but this year, Dad and I would like to get back on stage. We haven't been on stage since last year, and last year was a very, very brief dalliance. Dad and I keep joking about wanting to go to New Zealand, but I think that's a pretty serious idea. So yeah, I don't normally do housekeeping like this, but it's been a while, so I figured I would check in and just let you know that, you know, what would help us. So that's all the time we have for this part one look at the BTK killer. We'll see you later on this week for Loose Ends. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye, folks.
Cheerio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.